This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network.
I'm sick with this, I'm sick with this. Since you wasn't a part of my judgment, my own sweet time didn't teach what I felt. I didn't recognize simple things anymore. I don't want to be defeated, I don't want to be defeated, I don't want to be defeated, I don't want to be defeated.
Oh, hi. I didn't see you there. What's up? Welcome to another episode of the podcast of the show, Lead Singer Syndrome. I am your host, as always, Dr. Shane Told. No, I'm not a doctor. Mr. Shane Told, I guess, is appropriate. Yes, I have no title. I'm just call me Shane. I am here with another fantastic episode. I think one of the best we've had in a while, to be honest. Very excited for this episode with the front woman of Sharp Tooth, Lauren Cashin. Cashin, Cashan, I'm not sure how to say it. Lauren from Sharp Tooth is on the program today. A great episode, very entertaining. Just sit back and listen. There's a lot here to digest, to take in, and that's the way we like it around these parts. Well, thank you for being here with me. This is lovely. We have a beautiful day outside, wherever you are, I think. It's that time of year that I don't think it matters where you are. The hot places aren't too hot yet. The cold places aren't cold anymore. Spring is springing. Even if you're in Australia where it's like fall now, which always threw me off. I don't know. Your water going down the drain the wrong way just freaks me out every time I see it. I know it doesn't happen. But seriously, it's just a beautiful time on the planet. I love the positivity, and everything is going so well in my life. Thanks for asking. In fact, this Friday, my band Silverstein is releasing an interesting record, not a new record, but new recordings of some classic songs that we did the first 10 years of our career. It's called Redux, the first 10 years. Yes, very aptly named. So yeah, check it out on Friday. It'll be up on all the streaming services. And I know some people listen to this are fans of the band. Some people aren't. They don't care. Indifference. It's all good. But hey, maybe give us a second chance. Because some of those old recordings were, well, you're talking about 15 years ago. No money. We didn't really know what we were doing. But there's something in those songs. So go back. We re-recorded them. Not a remaster. Not a remix. This is... we literally went back in the studio. I re-sang all of these songs, and some of them came out pretty cool. So check it out on Friday. It's called Redux. It will be on all the streaming services. And if you go on to, I think it's SilversteinStore.com, we have CDs and vinyl up as well. They were sold out before, but they're back. So check that out. And yeah, things are great. I'm doing a lot of songwriting these days for my projects. I'm excited. And I don't know, there's something about the weather that just makes me feel inspired. So all good things. If you want to get in touch with me, I'm just an email away. I'm a like away. I'm a at reply away. Feel free to hit me up, leadsingersyndrome@gmail.com. It's at Shane Told on all the social medias, at leadsingersyndrome, at leadsingersyn, S-Y-N, on Twitter. Yeah, hit me up. Let me know what you think. If you got suggestions for the show, that's kind of how Lauren got on the show, I think. There was a lot of people that really wanted her on. And yeah, I hit her up through my friend Josh. And it's just a beautiful thing that she is here. And it really is a great episode.
What?
Sorry, I'm recording this as I'm watching Seinfeld in the background on mute. And how did George Costanza get women? Seriously, this piece of shit. Sorry, I digress. Congratulations to Brandon Drescher, who won the Lead Singer Syndrome All Access Club March Madness Extravaganza. He picked Virginia to win it all, and they did. Wow. Wow, wow, wow. Nobody had Texas Tech in the final, that's for sure, but they played their hearts out. And I got to say, this year, I think, was my favorite college tournament that I think I've seen. I mean, I think I watched more games than I have in like 10 years. So I had a lot of fun, and thanks to all the sinners that played alongside me. I was in the lead for a while. I finished in like 12th place, which is not a great showing, but you know, when Duke gets knocked out and they're your champion, you know, it happens. If you want to know more about this kind of stuff that we do in the Lead Singer Syndrome All Access Club, check it out. LeadSingerSyndrome.com/all access. You can be a part of this group and get bonus episodes and get stuff sent to your house. And it only costs as little as $6 a month to join. So again, check it out. LeadSingerSyndrome.com/all access. Well, I think it's time. Let's get into it. It's a great one. Sit back and listen to my conversation with Lauren of Sharptooth. I'm here with Lauren of Sharptooth. This is fantastic. Thank you for having me, allowing me to have you. And
yes.
Whichever way it goes. So, and I was just saying to you before the phone got disconnected and all messed up, I never do these things in the evening. So this is a nice way to set the tone, I feel.
Oh, I'm glad. I feel honored.
Absolutely. So what's new with you right now? I know you're off tour. You're working some kind of day job. What goes on kind of day to day with you right now?
Well, right now I'm not so much working as a recording. We're in the studio right now.
Oh, that's exciting. Yeah. That's exciting.
Yeah, it's super exciting. We've been tracking vocals this week and last week. So I've been in it.
You've been in it.
Yes, yeah. I've been in it.
Absolutely. Well, that was in my list of questions, is asking you about a new record, because Clever Girl came out, what, it's been like a year and a half now?
Yeah, it'll be like 2 years this fall.
Okay.
It came out October 2017, which feels insane.
Yeah. Well, what's happened?
Yeah.
So, you know, when you say you're in it, I mean you are a person that when you are making music, performing it, writing it, mm-hmm. recording it, you're not holding back with what you're feeling.
No.
You're not, you know, watering down anything that you're thinking, let alone, or saying, let alone thinking. So is it a lot for you just emotionally to go through the process of writing and recording an album?
That sums it up.
Okay.
I'm a lot emotionally, period. Like I describe the way that I feel and experience life as just kind of like turned up to like 11 all the time. The great is fucking incredible and the bad is unbelievably terrible. Mm-hmm. And so that 100% translates into my music. And it's so funny because like I've been working on these songs for the past couple months, and I've had like just been kind of like steadily getting work done on them. And I was talking to my boyfriend about like kind of like the timeline for recording the album. And I was like, oh yeah, I have like this many songs to finish. He's like, you like said that like it's like a laundry list item.
Right.
But it's me. So it was funny because like, so last week I was working on a song and fast forward and it's like 2 a.m. and I'm in my car in a parking lot at like a state park, like, and I've been crying in my car for 3 hours. And I was like, I don't know why I thought that I could ever write a record without that. You know, he's like, yeah, I don't know why you thought that either, but I don't want to say anything.
Well, you can't and you shouldn't.
Exactly. He's like, it wouldn't be you if it wasn't that.
That's a great point you bring up, though. Like, there really is so much of what, you know, we do as, like, in the music industry, as people that are essentially, like, we're getting paid or enabling, people are enabling us to, you know, do this and do this for some monetary reward, you know, or not really, but whatever. That's a whole other conversation.
Quote unquote reward, right?
At least we don't have to go get jobs at Home Depot or whatever, I guess, right, at the moment, you know, or for months at a time, whatever it is.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there's this duality between, okay, just go do it, do these shows. Oh, here's 30 shows in a row, go do it. Or here's 12 songs on a record, go record them. And then the actual like meaning and emotion and feeling behind it, which is the whole point of it. But yet you're supposed to just be kind of like...
Like it's a job.
Yeah, like just, I don't know, the minimized into just doing it.
Mm-hmm.
How is that ever easy?
Exactly. It's so funny because like, and I'm an extremely pragmatic person with any, like pretty much anything in my life. I'm very much like, okay, you make a list or you make a spreadsheet and you go through it and you get shit done.
Yeah.
But it's like, somehow like when it comes and like, so like in a lot of aspects, I'll treat being in a band with a lot of the same like pragmatism,
sure.
except I forget that like, yeah, this is the most like emotionally intense, grueling, gut-wrenching thing that people can do is create like art that that like comes from your fucking soul.
Right. And I think that that's why so many bands are bad at the business side of it too. You know, because a lot of bands and a lot of singers and stuff, just they need a hands-off approach from all the things that you have to do, like the checklists. So like, okay, we got to go reserve a bus, or like you guys are going to Europe pretty soon, like getting a back line and those things that like are absolutely have nothing to do with being creative musically, you know, but they have to get done. And those things are a lot of times the things that fall by the wayside unless you have that pragmatic, you know, approach.
Yeah. It's funny because before we got signed, when we were just doing DIY touring, I was the person who pretty much like did all of our like booking and shit. So I would book our tours and all of that and essentially tour manage for us.
Yeah.
Now that we're, you know, playing shows on the level that we are now, I cannot do that mentally or emotionally,
right.
because there's a huge difference between being able to shoulder the weight of TMing a tour that's like 2 weeks and like that I booked myself and it's whatever, and being able to handle that emotionally at the same time, and then like doing something like playing Warped Tour and trying to handle that emotionally or like a full US, and it's just like I am such an emotionally intense person that at this level, I can't like TM and stuff. But like the good news is that like our guitarist does like a ton of that now, and he's amazing at it. And so, we have actual help now.
there you go. So going through this process now of writing versus what you went through whenever it was 2 or 3 years ago before, you know, you'd done Warped Tour and you'd done all the full US tours and Europe and all that before that had been a thing. What's the differences now when you're approaching this, just for you? Like, obviously you've had a lot of experiences over the last 2 years that you're writing about, and the world's gotten pretty fucked up. Is the approach that you just take differently, or is it still kind of like you get back in the studio and it's the same way you've kind of approached it before?
Well, it was interesting because when we recorded Clever Girl, most of the songs were written long before we ever booked time in the studio, because they were the songs we'd been playing just like as a band for the year and a half before we went into the studio. So we already like had all these songs that were like done and that we'd been playing out for a year and a half.
Right.
There were like maybe like 2 or 3 that we kind of had to write, that like I at least wrote like on the come up to like approaching the studio. And there was like one song, actually No Sanctuary, that I wrote part of like in the vocal booth, but it was a totally different experience.
Right.
This was like
way harder, right?
Oh my God. So much harder, so much more pressure.
Yeah.
Cause like we didn't have, nothing was riding on Clever Girl. It was just me and my friends wanted to take the songs we'd been playing, put them together and give them to the world. There was no record label. There was nothing. I sent that record to maybe 30 labels and didn't hear back. And we said, fuck it, we'll just put it out ourselves because who cares? Like,
yeah.
We were like, oh, it would have been cool if we had like a label, like pay for some of it. Like,
right.
But like, we had no ambitions like really of that. That was like very wishful thinking and like, oh, that'd be really neat. But now it's like, you know, it's like a sophomore album.
Sure.
So there's a lot of pressure on that.
Sure.
And
well, you're admitting it. I mean, some bands don't admit it. Some bands I talk to say, oh, no, you know, whatever. And then it's like, and then I remind them that no band has ever made a bad second album and survived. So, you know,
right?
And they're like, oh yeah, shit, you're kind of right. But does the pressure, does a lot of pressure come from your fans now? Because, you know, you're so outspoken mm-hmm. on stage in interviews. You make a point to go talk to your fans after the show. And mm-hmm. obviously you're getting a lot of feedback from probably from a lot of female fans, but also mm-hmm. from just all your fans.
Yeah.
That what you're saying holds a lot of importance and holds a lot of weight. So now you're sitting on your couch or you're in the studio or you're doing whatever you do to write. Those mm-hmm. people must come into your mind.
Yeah, it definitely plays a role in it. And before I knew the shape and the theme that this record was going to take, I had a lot of insecurity about like that, like kind of like meeting people's expectations. It's an extremely different record from Clever Girl.
Okay.
But I think that one of the things that I think people can always expect from us, like, so this record I think Clever Girl had songs that had incredibly intensely personal elements, but I think that this overall record that I'm writing right now is the most personal I've ever written ever. So, but it's always important for me to be able to articulate these personal experiences in a way that will be in a way that's universal.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So that people aren't just like essentially reading a diary entry of mine, because who gives a shit? I wanted this to tie into, you know, things that like, I think a lot of people go through and experiences yeah. that a lot of other people have had. So, you know, I might be writing about a particular experience I had with a shitty fucking person, but I want to talk about the parts of that experience that are universal, especially like in regards to something that I've talked about in a lot of my songs, like things that are universal in a lot of ways to the feminine experience.
Right.
So yeah. So it definitely, that is something that I always come back to, is trying to figure out how to articulate things in a way where they will have a feel that is at least universally digestible and understandable
for sure,
to people.
For sure. Absolutely. So I want to go back, if you don't mind, and talk about, you know, your upbringing, how you kind of got into, you know, this whole thing.
Sure.
If you don't mind, I know you're from Baltimore area.
Yes.
And you kind of grew up going to hardcore shows and moshing and all that. But
yeah.
What was it like for you? What was it like for you in the early years? Like, what was your family structure kind of like? Do you have brothers and sisters? How was music in the household? What were you like in school? I just think those things are always kind of interesting and don't always get talked about.
So I'm adopted. So that was like, I guess, the first thing. And I consider that to be a thing of primary, like a very significant thing.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Because, oh Lord, do I have abandonment issues.
Well,
a lot of them can stem from that.
Yes. were you very young when you found out? Did you always know? Or
I've always known. I don't know when I was told. Mm-hmm. I think that was, I don't know if my parents like every day came into my room, were like, put you to bed, good night. Oh, by the way, you're adopted, like every night until like I was cognizant of it. I don't know.
Oh my God.
How else would you do that?
I don't know if that's the best way or the worst way.
I don't know, right?
Right.
Yeah, I have no idea. I have always known, and it was never considered like a big deal. So I never thought about it as being a big deal until I got a lot older and like went into therapy, and my therapists were like, this is actually a big deal, even if you don't want to believe it is. And I was like,
right.
Oh shit. Okay.
Right.
So yeah, my childhood, I was always like, when I was I have like a younger brother, he's 3 years younger than me. And,
he's not adopted too?
No, he's not.
Okay.
My parents didn't think they could have kids.
Right.
So they adopted me, and then surprise, David came along. And what's actually kind of funny is we all look alike. Like, if you look at a picture of me and my family, I look very much related to them. Like, my dad and my brother both have lighter eyes and freckles and auburn hair.
Well, okay.
Yeah, it's like we have similar facial features. It's very, very weird, but kind of cool. People have asked if my brother and I are are like fraternal twins.
Wow.
That's happened before.
Wow.
Because we're like so similarly complected. But yeah, like I had a pretty good childhood. I was a weird tomboy, loved books, loved reading, loved science fiction, loved dinosaurs, never grew out of that. But I was a huge tomboy. I think I've ever talked about this before. And when I was in like elementary school, I was pretty committed to the name Jake for a while.
Okay.
Yeah. I would get like kind of hostile if people called me Lauren. And I know that there obviously are kids out there who are trans and who like very much know that when they are like kids. I don't think that was not necessarily that experience for me. I think that experience for me was rooted in the fact that all of the characters that I liked in my favorite, like in my favorite books and like, you know, video games and stuff, they were all boys. They all got to do like the cool shit. So Jake, here's a throwback. Does anyone remember Animorphs? So Jake was like the main character of my favorite book series, Animorphs. And like, so
I'm not familiar with it. I'm sure a lot of people listening are, but I am not familiar. No.
Did you live in the 90s? Oh my God.
Well, yeah, kinda. Yeah. Kinda. I did. But I.
So they're the books with the covers of like the kids turning into an animal.
Okay.
I'm sure you've seen like memes of it at the very least.
Oh, yeah, maybe I have. You know what? I don't know. Maybe we didn't have it in Canada. That's just my excuse for when I don't know anything. I'm like, we just didn't get that.
Well, that was my like favorite series as a kid. It is still one of my favorite series to this day. It holds up very well.
Holy shit. Hang on a second. I just looked it up. It is from Canada. Canada.
No.
Yes. It was made for YTV. That was a Canadian station for season one and Global for season two. Another Canadian thing. There you go.
Yeah,
broadcast from 98 to 2000. So that's the thing. So it's probably a little bit because I'm 38. So I think I would have been 17, 18. I was already playing punk rock at this point. So.
Oh, okay. So yeah, it was like a big thing. So like the books came out in like 95 and like, so I was like 7, 8 years old. They're way too mature and graphic for kids that age to be reading, but here I was. And, yeah, so like there were these kids who could turn into animals to fight aliens, which was the coolest thing ever. Combined all of my favorite things, and so like the main character was this kid named Jake, who was like this like natural leader, and like he just had so many like qualities that I identified with, and you didn't really see like a lot of strong female characters in like film and TV, and especially in science fiction. Like, no, that guess, was not heard not. Of at I mean, all until I think the first time I saw like a quote unquote strong female character in science fiction or fantasy was when I was a little bit older and started watching Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Oh, right. Of course. Yeah.
And then I was like, yo, she's a boss ass bitch. I fuck with this. But before that, I didn't have anything. So when my friends and I would want to play like pretending games and like would want to be characters from like movies and books, I would always want to be characters that were boys because they were the ones doing the cool stuff. And yeah, it's just, I don't know that says anything about like my gender identity, but like it definitely says a lot about the film and TV industry and the sexism that's been there for decades and decades.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's no question. So you're going through this kind of thing.
Tomboy, wannabe Jake
and all this. So when did music become, you know, something that was important?
Music was like always important. Like when I was a kid, I would always get really into the soundtracks of movies. I'm actually like my first like forays into music. I was really into like hip hop when I was a kid. I really loved like Puff Daddy and the Family and Biggie when I was like 11, which I don't know why I was allowed to listen to any of that when I was 11, but I started getting into like songs with guitars. Actually, you know what? I remember the first time I heard like a punk rock song and went, oh my God, this is cool, was my friend Philip. gave me a cassette tape, a mixtape that he made, and it had Right Now by SR71 on it.
I guess that's punk rock.
At the time, that was like punk. That was the most punk rock thing I'd ever heard.
Sure,
and I was,
sure.
And I was just like, this is so cool. And so I'm like, I don't know that I really went anywhere with that. Like, I was very much into like musical theater and like did a lot of that and did singing lessons when I was like a kid.
Okay.
But then once I got into high school, I kind of rediscovered SR71 and then much heavier and much more actually like punk rock.
Right. SR70, that's a band name I haven't heard in years.
They were my favorite band in high school.
Wow.
And so they were no one else's favorite band in high school, but they were mine and I felt special and different because of it.
Yeah.
But then I loved like, you know, all the like early 2000s, like post-punk bands that like everybody listened to. Like I loved like Taking Back Sunday and Fall Out Boy and like, we were listening to Silverstein at the time.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah.
Aren't they from Baltimore? SR71?
They are, which
well,
is
there
cool.
You go. Okay. Then they, so, yeah. So, I mean, is that something, I guess that's had happened. So like bands, you know, regional bands can be really big in the town they're from, especially a town like that. I think Baltimore kind of takes care of their own. You know, another band I think of when I think of like really big and like a local band that's done a lot is like Story of the Year. Like they're huge in St. Louis. Like they play,
oh my God.
They sell out like 2,500 cap room in one day in St. Louis. Like every time they play it, you know. So I guess that's probably the reason. But that's a band. Yeah, I remember them being around for
they
a
were
while.
Like a one-hit wonder to the rest of the world.
But right,
they
right.
Were special here. That was my first ever like concert, like real like. Like actual like rock concert was an SR71 show. I was 14 years old and my friend Andy's mom dropped us off in her minivan and we went to the concert and was when you could still smoke in venues. And
so the worst.
I was wearing like a jean jacket and a lot of black and it felt very cool. And I came home smelling like cigarettes and I was like, that was so cool. Like, yeah, just like little 13, 14 year old girl.
Oh yeah. No, I can't do the smoking and I'm old enough to, you know, being like, I was still in a band, we were on tour, like when you could still smoke in a lot of venues. And I think my favorite thing that ever happened was most of the US venues, the smoking was gone. But in Europe, in Germany, there was still a lot of smoking going on.
Mm.
There isn't anymore, but at the time there was. And I remember the first show, we were playing this like shitty little, you know, venue, so small and packed and everyone's smoking. And I was like dead the next day from the smoke. So I said, it's terrible. So I said to the, you know, the tour guy, the promoter, whatever, who's doing this run of shows for us. I was like, hey, is there any way we can have the venue be like not smoking tomorrow? So he's like, well, you know, people are like pretty used to it. So like, I don't know. And I'm like, okay, well, whatever. So
oh my God.
Didn't say a word about it. I was just going to kind of, you know, suck it up. Literally. And what he did was he put signs on the wall all over the venue. And I didn't really know he was doing this because he did it like right before doors. So the signs were in German, but they said no smoking tonight as the singer for Silverstein is allergic or something like that. So all of a sudden I look like, oh, totally. So I look like a total, you know,
like a diva.
Diva,
oh,
sure.
No.
And I didn't know this. And so I'm like looking around and our guitar player said that he saw a guy rip the sign off the wall, light it on fire, and then use it to light a cigarette with.
Oh my God.
So yeah. So
if that ain't dramatic.
So sorry for the tangent off topic.
Wow.
But yeah. So
that's incredible. Incredible.
Yeah, fuck smoking, but
I can't do it. So I actually, this is kind of funny. I smoked for 12 years, pack a day, Marlboro Reds. I was very, very committed. I loved smoking and I quit before the first ever like actual Shark Tooth tour because I was like, I'm not going to be able to do these songs.
Oh, good for
you. Like, and I quit. It was like September of like 2015. And that's when that And haven't smoked since. And I've,
oh, good for you.
Like, so.
Good for you. So well, anyway.
So sharp tooth is why. Well,
it's I mean, it's good for your health, you know? I mean, not just your not just your voice, but your health in general. So SR71 is your favorite band in high school. You're wearing a jean jacket. You're pretty cool. Smoking, yes. smoking some cigs.
Right.
And when did you get more into, you know, the kind of hardcore and the scene that, that Sharp Tooth's a part of now?
So I started, so in about like halfway through high school was when I started listening to like heavier bands, like metalcore bands of that era, like Atreyu, old like Avenged Sevenfold from First to Last was on there. A lot of He's Legend.
Oh yeah. Great new record coming out.
I
heard
it. Oh my God.
I heard a sneak preview. Yeah? I heard a sneak preview. It's a good record.
I mean, I heard the new song that they released and that was tight.
That's it's like probably their best record. Anyway, go on.
I was very much into that kind of stuff, like some Every Time I Die thrown in there. And I didn't get so much into like the hardcore scene at that time because it was so prohibitive. I remember having friends in that scene and like I would talk to them about like they were like, oh, like we're going to go see like Diamond Youth. And I'm like, oh, that's like, that sounds so like, can I come? And they were like, yeah, no clit in the pit. Like straight up. That was a thing that, yeah, that my friends said to me. That's how much of an accepted like part of that culture. And it, like, that's how accepted like sexism was, like just period.
Yeah,
because
well,
like,
I mean, hardcore has, now, hardcore has, yeah, go ahead, sir. Yeah. I mean, hardcore has a not so great history of misogynistic lyrics, attitudes, a lot of horrible behind the scenes shit going on. Like, I'm not going to call out specific bands, but it's been running rampant for literally decades.
Of course. And you know, it was just like the most shocking thing about it, like to me now, is that, you know, at the time that like my friends saying, like laughing and saying, yeah, no clit in the pit. Like, it hurt my feelings and made me sad, but I was like, shit, I mean, you're right. Like, okay. Like
wow.
I like, because that's, that was the way it was. And it was like the same as like, you know, same time, you know, I was when I first started teaching myself like how to scream and, my friends had like a, they had like a weird experimental kind of hardcore band and they were auditioning vocalists. And I was like, hey, can I audition? They're like, yeah, we don't want a girl in the band. And I was like, oh, okay. Like, I get it. And like, just the fact that...
Had you heard Walls of Jericho at this point?
No.
Okay.
Mm-mm. Like, really the only girls that I'd heard in like any kind of like music like ours were like... I mean, there was a girl in Flyleaf and there was Evanescence.
Right, right. So yeah, like Walls of Jericho or like Undying or like, you know, one of my favorite like, bands when I was in, you know, in high school, I guess.
So that the problem was that like I think that we were almost too young to have heard that yet. Like that
right,
was like
right.
Like older metal and like we had basically missed that. We were on that other generation of bands coming up where like the only woman was like Haley from Paramore or like Avril Lavigne. At camp they would call me Mini Avril, which was hilarious. Because that was literally the only context that anybody had for a woman in punk music or in any kind of alternative kind of music was Hayley Williams or Avril Lavigne.
Right.
Like, and no disrespect to any of them. They play great music. I'm none of those artists, though. That's been, like, I think one of the more challenging things is, like, I think for a lot of women is carving out an identity that is very much our own in this music because you're constantly getting compared to people that you don't sound anything like because they're the only other women, you know?
Yeah.
So that was a thing I like struggled with for years. They were like, yeah, we're not trying to do the Paramore thing. And I'm like, well, that's not how I sound or what I'm trying to do, but I mean, okay. And you just take it. Cause that was I had nobody else who was like, I don't really agree with that. Like, it was just me. So you just go, okay. And you move on with your
well,
life.
Well, when you decided not to say okay anymore and you know, and you started, you know, saying, well, fuck this. I'm going to start, you know, start a band, whatever. And was that anger that you have still in your music and it being so driven towards that because of that unacceptance that you faced? Was there like a media backlash, you know, like that you had?
Well, I have. So like all of the bands that I've ever, so like the first band that I was ever in, I didn't join until I was out of college or like in college. So I was out of high school.
Right. Right.
Didn't matter how much I wanted to play a band in high school. That just wasn't going to happen. But I got asked to join a band who were like mutual friends, but it was like, it wasn't in that scene. So the band was like kind of like a progressive ska type of band.
Okay.
It was cool. It was experimental. It was weird. I have singing background in pretty much any genre from opera to musical theater to ska and metalcore. So I can sing in a lot of different styles. So I did that for a couple of years, and it was a really fun band. It was called At the Zoo, and it was like the Mars Volta with trumpets.
Cool.
And it was tight. Yeah, it was great. I still think that band was sick. But they invited me to join. They were like, we're looking for a singer. We know that you went to Carver, which was the art school I went to in high school. We've heard you have a really good voice. Do you want to try singing for this band? I was like, hell, finally! Finally, I get to do it! I did that. And then, you know, this whole time, so I'm like in that music scene, the more like, it's almost like more of like a hippie kind of scene, but I'm going to, on my own, like metalcore shows.
Right.
At that point, I'd been exposed to Every Time I Die and like kind of went head first into like the Baltimore mosh scene. And like that was kind of my thing that I just struck out on my own. And I would go to every fucking show in Baltimore. I'd go to like two or three shows a week. I didn't care if I knew the bands. I didn't care if I knew nobody there. I was just so stoked because I'm like, I get to mosh. Like, that's all I care about. Like, I get stage dive, it's a mosh, like I get to find new music. This is the greatest thing in the world. Which I think for a lot of other people is something that they start doing a lot earlier. Like, I feel like a lot of people get that like mosh fever when they're like 14, 15. I didn't get that until like I was like 20 because people didn't really want girls at their shows when I was 14 and 15.
Yeah.
No clit in the pit, you know?
So yeah, geez, that's just such a terrible, like, I've never heard it.
It's such just, an aggressive, fucked up phrase.
Yeah, like, I feel so uncomfortable. You've said it three times or four times. Every time, I just gets a little worse.
Good. You know, that's reparations. For all the times I had to hear it and feel bad.
Oh, my goodness.
You're doing the Lord's work right now, okay? I just want you to know.
So, you know, obviously there was this, I don't know the word for it. Sorry, I'm having trouble with my words finding it. But, you know, you say you come from like a pretty, you know, normal family and everything. And now you're at the age 20 or whatever, and you just want to go three or four times a week or whatever you said to mosh to get out some kind of aggression, some kind of rage. Oh, like, what was going on that you needed to get out of your system?
So, in the intermittent years, because we kind of did a little bit of a jump there.
Yeah.
So when I was in high school, I dealt with several instances of sexual assault when I was a teenager. And my coping mechanisms for that weren't so great. Mm-hmm. And definitely had like pretty intense drinking problem that I used to self-medicate and to that I didn't have to think about how worthless I felt anymore.
Right.
And by the time I graduated from high school, which like I can't believe I graduated, I'd been kicked out of high school. They took me back, but like I'd been expelled and I'd been in like several treatment programs. And like none of it was really, the problem was that like the way that our society treats drug and alcohol abuse is very often that the problem is the drug and alcohol abuse as opposed to what is the drugs and alcohol being used for.
Right.
So these people are telling a 17-year-old girl that she has alcoholism, which is somewhat absurd. Your brain's not even finished developing.
Right, sure.
And so one of the treatment programs that I was sent away to ended up being a legitimate actual cult. And it was an extremely abusive place.
Yikes.
There were people, it wasn't like a, like, and I'd been to treatment centers, so I knew like what, you know, I knew what the deal was with like rehab and shit. This was not like that. So you didn't live at a facility. You went down to Florida and you lived in this community and you could only ever talk to people who were also in the community. And there were, you worked in the community. You had no outside contact outside of the community. And there were people who'd been there for 5, 10, 15, 20 years and had limited to no contact with the outside world.
That's just weird.
It was very, very insane. It was very, very abusive. They would have like group therapy where they'd have rape victims in the same room talking about their rape, with rapists in the room. Like sitting, staring at people who you know are there because they raped somebody and you're having to talk about.
Weird.
Like, it was extremely fucked up, the things that they did
to
people.
So how long were you there for?
I was there for 14 months.
Oh, my goodness.
And I'm still undoing a bunch of shit. Thank God for good therapists.
Isn't that just awful? You know, that can happen, that therapy can make it worse, you know?
Yeah. And it's like,
God,
it's so fucked. I have a very good friend who was one of the other people who was there with me. And like, it's wonderful having her as a friend because she's like the one person I can talk to who about that experience, who I know understands like all of it and like the depth to which that fucks you up, because you go there and you're at the most vulnerable position of your life and you are just like, I will do anything to feel better. Mm-hmm. And then these people tell you that this is the only way you're going to feel better. And you have like, what are you supposed to do? Who are you supposed to believe? Mm-hmm. I wasn't allowed to talk to my family for months. I had no contact with my friends. I had friends who wrote me letters for that entire time, and they never gave any of the letters to me.
And oh, my God.
So you feel like you have been abandoned by the entire world. And so then, and they're like, we're the only thing, the only people who care about you. So you, what are you supposed to do? You know, it's very hard to not get brainwashed when you're at that low point. And when you have 100 people telling you that this is the only way for you to survive.
Wow. Okay.
It's a lot.
It's a lot. Well, yeah, but I mean, you're describing kind of where you're at. So, I get it. I don't really know what to jump to next, but you know, I guess with the band,
well, I know you.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I know you'd asked about like where that anger came from.
Yeah. Oh, right. That's right.
And it's like, you know, when I got out, I pretty much stopped taking my medication, threatened to run away a bunch of times, and then threatened to run away and bring new people. If you would run away from there, they'd call the cops and say you were a suicide risk, so you'd get thrown in the psych ward. Right.
May have been better, actually. But
it may have been better, but like also worse, because then you have even less control over anything in your life.
That's true.
Like, so it just was like, do I want to be thrown in a fucking room or have any leverage? So I basically, I threatened to run away with new people, and they didn't want to throw like 8 of us into the psych ward at once. So that day they called my parents, got me a flight, and like literally dropped me off on the curb at the Orlando airport. Suddenly I was home and terrified of like anything I said or do would result in me going back. So you're just trying to get by and put as much mental distance between you and that experience as possible. But like, you can't reconcile the anger and the hurt and the pain that like you just endured.
Right.
And the only place where I found release for that was moshing at shows and screaming my fucking head off.
There you go. Well, I mean, hardcore punk rock is like, I mean, a lot of people say it's therapy. The scene is, you know, can be so positive and so good for so many people. I don't know where I would be without it. Obviously, everyone has their own experiences, and everyone takes what they need from it. But it is something that, you know, it's I'm a lifer. You know, I'm a lifer because of it.
It became my if you had asked me like at that time, I would tell you that it was my religion. Like that's how tight I grabbed onto that, because it was the only thing that ever made me feel okay after that. And it was like the only way that like I found like my sense of identity and self and like the power to be able to heal and start feeling like I had a voice again. So yeah, I literally had like it was like a religious thing for me.
So when you were going to the shows and having this, you know, I guess like, you know, you were a fan mostly, right? Of this. You were, you know, you hadn't started the band yet. Do you have aspirations to start this? Was it kind of your dream to do what you're doing now?
Like never as like a career. It was always so like I like at that time, you know, I'm in college, I'm getting a degree in zoology, and I'm like, that's my life path is I'm gonna be a zoologist, I'm gonna work with reptiles, I'm gonna work in zoos, it's gonna be great. But like I always like, you know, I would immediately leave class and go and walk on heads, like you know, at the show, like 15 minutes down the road. And I had a lot of friends that I made in that scene, and we, you know, we talked about, you know, starting a band together. And me and my one friend Austin, we finally got around to starting a band together that was like kind of like a pop punk hardcore crossover band called Highest Honor. And we did that for a while, and that was great, really fun. We specialized in like emo song covers.
Oh, nice.
In addition to our originals. But we were like,
Do any recordings exist of this?
Of Highest Honor or of our covers?
Well, either one. I mean, the covers would be really great, but.
There's a really great live version of We Did It's Dangerous Business Walking Out Your Front Door.
Oh,
that's like probably
yeah.
our most recent one.
There you go.
Yeah. And
oh yeah, it's so good.
Yes. Yeah, so we like that was like we did that for a while and like made a ton of friends playing shows with Highest Honor, and that like became like our baby. And then it was like December of 2014. I got approached by Lance, the guitarist for Sharptooth, and he was like, hey, I've got this band and we're looking for a vocalist. We'd specifically really love to have like a woman as like our front person. We'd love to get like a woman's perspective on things. And
awesome.
I was heavily involved in like local activism at the time and like regularly going to protests and like very much involved in like local politics. So I was like, well, so like I kind of knew Lance like a little bit like from the local scene, but we weren't like super close or anything. And I'm like, are you going to tell me what I can and can't write about? And he was like, fuck no, dude, you can write about whatever the fuck you want. I'm like, can I write some real like girl power feminist type shit?
Right.
He was like, hell yeah. And I was like, do you care if I talk politics? And he's like, fuck yeah, let's do it. I'm like, okay, let's fucking do it.
Okay, there you go.
So we busted out like a whole bunch of songs in that month and immediately started playing shows.
Wow.
And it felt great to be able to feel like I was writing music that was heavier than the stuff I had been playing and where I felt like I could really be honest.
Totally. Well, you guys started out, you know, a kind of an underground band, you know, doing local shows around, you know, the East Coast and whatever.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, you guys get signed and now you've done tours with, you know, supporting a lot of bands whose fans don't necessarily care about what you're saying or what you're going to tell them. Is it important now for you guys to have gotten to this level now where you have a platform where you're not just preaching to the converted, you know what I mean? You're not going to be in a place where like it's the thing, like, and I don't want to offend anybody, so I'll preference it, but it's like when you go to a Christian show and some band goes, says something like blah, 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 Jesus Christ. And then the whole room starts clapping because everybody there is like, you know,
is a
Christian.
Yeah.
And that's the, you know, and on a lesser level, it's the same thing. Like when you go to like an anti-flag show and, you know, and they're like shit talking Donald Trump and everybody there like is at an anti-flag show. So they know that like everyone there is clapping too, right? But mm-hmm. for you,
I feel very fortunate that that was our first full U.S.
Right. I mean, the best guys ever, just ever.
Perfect human beings.
I know. I just, yes. Oh my God. I think we were trying to, we did a co-headliner with them out in Europe like last year, and we were trying to get you guys on the bill. I remember.
Why'd you forget? No, I'm kidding.
We were on board. I feel
what
like you guys,
were we?
I feel like you couldn't do it or something. You had something else going on, but
that's dumb.
Yeah, we were, I was hoping that was going to work out, but aww. That's the way this shit works, you know, but
totally is.
But back to my long-winded point and question here, you don't have that ever. Like, you know, you don't ever go into an environment where it's about a bunch of women that are just like you, mm-hmm. that are going to clap at everything you say. Like, it's going to get uncomfortable the way that you are,
yeah.
How honest you are and stuff on stage. But at the same mm-hmm. time, it's important for you to get in front of those people that might be like, hey, wait a second. Maybe I'm a little uncomfortable, but maybe there's a reason I'm uncomfortable.
I've had so many experiences, very positive ones, with people who've come up to me and said, you said a lot of shit that made me extremely uncomfortable, but thank you.
Right.
And like it's fucking important. You know, if we as a society don't start, you know, rolling up our sleeves and having mm-hmm. those uncomfortable conversations, shit will not change. You know, and it's like, it's funny because it's like, you know, you're talking about like anti-flag, about how like everyone at an anti-flag show is like, you know, here for the anti-flag message. But, you know, when they first started touring, that was not the case at all. Like, a lot of, like, the bands at the forefront of, like, these genres, like, think about bands like Fugazi and Minor Threat. They would, like, go play shows and talk about shit, and people would be fucking livid with yeah. the stuff that they were saying. I was actually, this yeah. is a great, great story from today, actually. So we're recording with Brian McTernan, and he was telling...
Oh my God, are you? I didn't know you were. I love McTernan. Oh my God. Tell him I said hi.
He's perfect. I adore him, and I absolutely will. He was telling me about when he was, like, a kid going to, like, see, watching Ian MacKaye on stage talking about, like, with a pro-gay message. And, like, just being profoundly shocked because he'd never heard anybody on stage like backing gay people.
Right.
Because like in the mid early 90s, that was not a thing. Not a thing. Like people would use the F slur like in such a pejorative way. Like, I mean, people still do that, but like that was very accepted then.
Sure.
And like calling people gay as a slur was very accepted.
Sure.
Like, so, you know, I don't see, it's funny because I don't really see anything that my band does as being particularly unusual. I just think that people have a very short-term memory. And like, yeah, a lot of these bands would spend half their time on stage talking.
Yeah.
And like proselytizing about the social and political issues that they were passionate about.
When I was in high school, that was a thing too. I mean, a lot of it was more to do with animal rights. Like, you know, mm-hmm. like Earth Crisis was a really like important band, you know, in kind of in my area. I know they're not from my area, but not too far away, Syracuse, New York. And the scenes were kind of rub off on us up in Canada, and those bands would come through. So, you know, veganism and all that was really prevalent, and those kinds of things were, and you know, there was a lot of anti-drug, you know, stuff going on. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of that straight edge movement and stuff like that. But so yeah, for me, it isn't weird to go to a show and have somebody tell me something socially responsible, whatever it is, or, you know,
me too.
But for a lot of people, especially when you start getting out of a place that has a local scene where all they have are like 1,000 cap seaters and they've only seen national acts touring,
mm-hmm.
Wherever you are in the world. then people sometimes are like, they've never seen that before. Especially yeah. when you're opening for, I don't know, Cane Hill or As It Is, or I mean, I shouldn't lump those bands together maybe, but you know what I'm saying.
But yeah, and it's funny that you bring up both of those bands, because you know what we do as a band, it's interesting because like depending on the tour, we'll have totally different experiences. I love every single person in Cane Hill and every person on that tour, but that was the hardest tour I've ever done.
I could see
that. I literally get emotional like thinking about it. I was like the most depressed that I'd ever been on a tour, because being a young woman staring at a room full of like male nu metal fans,
right,
talking about being raped every night for 7 weeks is very, very hard. On Warped Tour, you know, you get all these like these young people and these very progressive mindsets, like yeah. all these teenagers coming out, and they fuck with it. They're about it. They're about gay rights. They're like about like sexual like violence awareness. Like they're here for that. It was very, very hard yeah. on the Cane Hill tour. It felt like I was getting up in front of a firing squad a lot of nights, and it really did a number on me mentally.
Yeah, I can absolutely imagine that.
Yeah. I left that tour and I didn't know if I wanted to keep doing this. And that wasn't something that I really admitted to people at the time, but
no,
in hindsight, I can say that.
But now, okay. In hindsight now though, can you see that it was good work you were doing? Like there was some importance there. Like maybe you didn't reach everybody in that room, but at least put that out there so those people at least know it exists. Because a lot of times they don't even know it exists.
Yes. And I will always maintain that it was important. Especially like, so like you mentioned As It Is. So fast forward to the As It Is tour, where we're touring with a bunch of like post-punk and pop-punk bands, and it's all pretty boys on stage. And then Sharptooth, the feminist metalcore band. And the first night of that tour, I got on stage and I looked out into the crowd and I just see a sea of women. Right. And I get really emotional thinking about it. I was terrified to get on stage, because this was like this was coming off of like that Cane Hill tour, and just like that fear, like that had never gripped me before playing shows before. I had this terrified fear. And as soon as I got up there and I saw all of these young girls, it was just like a wave of like calm.
Yeah.
I was like, oh my God, I'm not alone in this room, and I'm not going to be alone in the experiences that I'm about to talk about. And it was like, I immediately felt safe. And then in talking about so many of these things, like so many issues that are like specific to the feminine experience, specific to the queer experience, and just seeing the eyes of these young girls light up when they're like, first they're looking at me like, oh God, what is this scary band? And then as soon as they like kind of like hear when I start talking, they're like,
yeah,
oh my God, this is for us. And I'm like, yes, bitch, this is for you. And I had so many girls going, I'd never heard a girl in a metal band before.
Right.
And I've never seen a girl talk. I've never seen a girl on a stage like that. I've never heard a girl talk about those things.
Well, when you were there, when you were their age, you hadn't either.
Exactly. And like that meant more to me than anything. Like I got off stage that night and I sat down and just sobbed. And I was like, I'm going to be okay.
I'm back, baby. I'm back.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I was like, this is why I'm here. I'm here for these, for like, and just them, the response that we got was unfucking real. I never in a million years expected that. I want to tour every tour in the U.S. with pop punk bands from now on.
There you go. Well, you touched on Warped Tour briefly, and you know Warped Tour is now over, except it isn't. Well, it isn't. It isn't really over, but the national tour part is over, and you know the last one you guys participated in it, and Warped Tour has a not so great reputation, I guess, among certain circles for not being inclusive of females, which in some ways is very debatable. And also has been called out for, you know, not being a safe space, which compared to other things is also maybe debatable. I mean, what's your take on this? Obviously, you there was a reason you did the tour and you had these experiences. So I'm kind of just, I just want your take on the whole thing.
Well, I've had people ask me about that, like, oh, you know, like people who've like committed sexual assault are like played Warped Tour. Why are you doing it? I'm like, that in and of itself is enough reason.
Okay.
Because there's always going to be terrible people, misogynist people, sexual predators, like problematic people on, I think, any tour.
Yeah.
So what am I supposed to do? Silence myself? Remove myself from that conversation? What good does that do to literally any of the kids going there?
Yeah.
That just removes the opportunity to start a conversation. And I think that that is, like, I think that there's an element of cowardice to that. I think that that's taking the easy way out. Mm-hmm. That's what, so, and like, this might, I don't know if people are going to think this is weird. I don't agree with like canceled culture at all, because I think that everybody is problematic. I think that literally nobody is born woke. I think that every single human being on this planet has done something that is racist, sexist, homophobic, transphobic, like ableist. Everybody, period. I don't care who you are. You've done shit that has hurt or oppressed other people. So what are you supposed to do? Remove yourself from that conversation? Fuck no. You go in there and you start the conversation and you fight it right on the fucking front lines. I think it's too easy to say, oh, so-and-so's canceled. End of story.
Right.
That doesn't give people, that doesn't make anybody want to look at their own behavior. That doesn't make anybody want to change. Right. All that does is make people think that they can point the finger at everyone else. And they forget the fucking three fingers pointing back at themselves. And like, it's so easy for me to get on stage. Yeah. So I have a kind of related funny story. I got some clothing company sent me a picture of a shirt and was like, we'd love to send you one of these. And the shirt said, like, rape sucks, kill all rapists. And I was like, first of all, that's fucking aggressive. I was
very aggressive.
Wow, that's a design choice you made. Second of all, like, one, you don't get to fucking make money off of the idea that rape sucks, fuck you. Like you saying that does nothing for anybody. Second of all, walking around with a shirt that says rape on it could literally be triggering to people who are victims of sexual assault.
True.
So like,
yes,
maybe don't just shove that in people's faces. And third, I don't agree with kill all rapists, because rapists are human beings. And people who, like, so it's like, I think that when you boil somebody down to the crime that they did, it is an exercise in, it's a very easy thing to do. Be like, oh, well, fuck you. You're a rapist. What's a lot harder is having to sit and look at a person for who they are as a person, and that's a member of your society. Mm-hmm. Why are they that way? What in me is like that person? That is a much, much, much more difficult pill for people to swallow.
Much more difficult. Yes.
So, yeah, it's very easy to say, you know, fuck Warped Tour. They've had people there who are abusers. I want to be the person there who is the antidote to that. You know,
there you go.
I want to be the person there who it, like, cause there's always going to be kids there, you know, if all the people fighting against abuse leave, what's left?
Well, then that's most other festivals is what I would argue. Which was my whole take. Everyone's saying, oh, Warped Tour is so terrible, such a terrible place. It's like, well, what about all these other festivals that don't have any sort of, you know, punk rock ethics? That are just a bunch of, you know, I don't know. Fuck, I'll just say it. You know, a bunch of bands from genres where it's way more male dominant and way worse and way less socially
progressive
in any way. And people think that that's a safer space. Why aren't those, types of environments the ones getting called out?
Exactly.
I guess it's because we expect more from Warped Tour, right? So maybe that's
maybe
I missed that point somewhere along the way, but I think a lot of people are missing it or missed it in a big way too. You know, and I know there's all those memes that have happened about people, oh ha 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 ha, you know, let's make fun of Warped Tour because some, you know, abuser was there or whatever, right? It's like it's like, maybe let's not make this into a meme. Like, maybe let's have a conversation about this and then actually, you know, deal with it and maybe try to make things better. What the fuck do I know, though?
What, I mean, I completely agree. I feel like when you are, when you abandon every potential avenue to actually start change, then you just leave vacant these spaces. And you... I really just think that, like, the most overwhelming thing is that people are afraid to do the actual hard work of activism.
Right.
And you know what isn't hard work? Abandoning shit. What is hard work is saying, okay, yeah, this is super problematic. Like, how can we make it better?
Yeah.
What are the things that we need to get in there and do? Well, how can we make this more accessible to people? Like, that requires actual thought, and that's not a thing that a lot of people want to do, especially when it's people who they like. There's a lot of people out there who just want to like jerk themselves off and consider themselves social justice warriors when they're not actually doing any of the actual real challenging emotional labor at looking at your own behavior, the behavior of the people around you, the behavior of your scene. Writing things off is about the easiest fucking thing you could do. It requires no effort.
Well, I won't paint you with that brush, that's for sure. Nobody could call you up for that.
I hate that. It's like, because you do that and it makes people like, that is the enemy of change, is saying that is pointing the finger and saying, this is what the enemy looks like.
Right.
Rather than saying, how have I been complicit in a lot of these oppressive systems? Because we all have.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And that's like so much kinder and gentler of an approach to take. And I mean, that's like, that's just been a thing I've been thinking about recently and kind of coming back to like, or my record, that's like a big theme in it, is that like at the crux of it, people just so often are not willing to have empathy for one another. And like are willing to, you know, you slap a label on something and say it's canceled and think that the problem's solved, but it's not solved. It's not solved for the person who still doesn't understand why what they did was wrong. It's not solved for the victims. It's not solved for anybody. It's just put under a rug. That's all any of that is just shoving shit under a rug. And I will never think that that's the answer.
There you go. Oh, I appreciate your honesty with that. Absolutely.
Thank you.
So we've been talking for a while. I don't want to take up too much more of your time. You got records to make and all these things you're doing. But I do want to ask you.
We're crying to do.
Well, I do want to ask you what, you know, you can tell the people that you have going on, you know, coming up. Obviously, this record is going to come out at some point. Do you have a date or an idea of a date?
We're not really sure yet. We would love for it to be out in the fall, but like that's you know how it is.
Sure,
like,
I do. But you guys, I mean, you're almost done. You must be almost done because you're hitting the road very soon. European tour with My Friends and Comeback Kid. You're playing Gros Rock. Then you're doing some shows with my Canadian brothers in Obey the Brave.
I know. We're hanging out with your Canada buddies. Really tight.
I forgot Comeback Kid was from Canada for some
reason. Right?
For one second, even though like they live, you know, right down the road. That's funny. So you love Canadians, obviously.
Counterparts. I mean,
oh yeah, there you go.
So many of my favorites are Canadian. Yeah. Oh my God. So excited for this Comeback Kid tour. They're like longtime influences of this whole band.
Yeah.
And it's like, seriously, like for our first Europe run, are you kidding me?
Oh,
like,
it's your first time. It's your first time there.
First time.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, wow. Enjoy. Cool. Well, Gros Rock is an incredible festival.
So excited. So many of my favorite artists are playing Gros Rock, and I'm humbled to be on a lineup with them. Like, oh my God. Like,
absolutely.
Stick to Your Guns is playing, and like Trade Winds and Get the Shot, who are more Canadian friends.
Get the Shot. That's a band we did some festivals with, I think, last year in Europe.
They are
a great band. And isn't Jawbreaker playing Girls Rock this year, or did I make that up?
I don't know. I think so. Yeah, no, I think they are.
Oh my God, incredible. Hopefully on the same day. That's really awesome.
Oh my God. Yeah, awesome. So we're super excited. We're doing Canada in May. We're doing a couple of days with Obey the Brave after that, and we're talking about maybe doing potentially a couple U.S. dates during the summer. I think we're gonna take it easy a little bit during the summer because we're about to drop a record.
It's gonna be crazy when you do, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly. So our sights are kind of set on fall. I'm also moving, so like it'll be nice to enjoy living in my new home.
Are you moving like in the same area, or are you moving like out of state?
No, I am moving to Boston.
Oh, cool.
In May. Yeah. Cool. Okay. Very excited.
Awesome.
So I'll be a little closer to your neck of the woods.
Yeah, sorta. Yeah.
Marginally.
Well, that's awesome. Well, I mean, I guess that about covers it. Anything else to tell the people?
Everyone should just be nice and treat everyone with kindness.
There you go. There you go. Well, I mean, but on a serious note, though, I mean, you are constantly trying to get your fans to do more, too. Are there any things you can recommend to people if they want to learn more about the band, about some of the causes and things that you're involved with?
Yes. So I do periodic like live streams on my Instagram channel. And recently I've kind of put out like an initiative to help compile resources for people because like because of what I do there, I get tons and tons of often teenagers asking me for like advice on life and mental health and like sexual assault issues, and I'm like, whoa, I'm a singer. I'm not a therapist. I'm not a counselor. I'm not a professional in any of these things. So, but there's clearly a need. Yep. People are clearly reaching out, which I think is amazing. So I've been trying to work on compiling a list of mental health resources for victims of sexual violence, and just anything that you could possibly be struggling with or that somebody could be struggling with, I am searching for resources for so that I can compile them into a list and share that for people. Okay. So what's
your Instagram handle so people
can
find that?
Claws. It's Kashan Claws, as in nails.
Not like not Santa Claus.
Not Santa Claus. Okay. Like,
got it.
Like Raptor Claws.
Got it. Yeah, go Raptors.
So yeah, if you have suggestions for that, I would absolutely love to have them to put on the list.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, and good luck with the rest of the record. And tell Mike Turner I said hi.
Yeah, thank you so much. I absolutely will. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Lauren.
All right, take care.
So there it is with Lauren. And I don't know how I didn't get all these dinosaur references before. Sharptooth, Clever Girl. It's all coming full circle now. Yes. I want to thank Lauren so much for doing this. And wow, I'm really excited to hear this new record. Brian McTernan is a legendary producer. He has made some incredible records, some of my favorite records. So I am really, really excited for the new Sharptooth, which is going to be coming out sometime soon, hopefully. And next week, I will be back with another episode. Make sure you're subscribed. Make sure you're following us on all the social media. And of course, remember, you can always hit me up on email. I read all my email. I try to get back to everyone. I haven't been great lately. Lots going on. But I do read it all, so if you want to send me a message, feel free, leadsingersyndrome@gmail.com. I really like the entire Sharptooth album, and I had a lot of trouble picking a track. I think my favorite track is probably the one I played in the intro, Left for Dead, but I'm going to play the title track of the record. Makes sense, why not? So here it is, Clever Girl. On Lead Singer Syndrome. Peace and love. See you next time.
Clever girl.
Dead men, tell no tales. Dead men, talk no shit. Dead men, tell no shit. Dead men, tell no shit.